Good morning. Welcome back to the Broadcast Retirement Network. This is BRN Weekly for Saturday, March 30th, 2024. At our top story today, how will markets react to a key inflation test? And joining me now to discuss this and a lot more, Jane King is a financial journalist, and she's joining us from the NASDAQ. Jane, so great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us on the program this morning.
Great to be back with you, Jeffrey.
And full disclosure for everyone, we're doing this a day early because Friday is Good Friday, Jane, and
yes.
Typically markets are closed. So you've been very gracious with giving us your time a day early. So thanks for that. Let's catch up on markets. How have markets done on this short week?
Well, they've been good, and we're also wrapping up the first quarter. And so it's been a great first quarter for stocks. The S&P 500 is going to close out the first quarter right around 10%. The NASDAQ right around 9%. I mean, imagine like if they would do that all year, that'd be like a 40% gain for the year, which would be crazy.
That'd be amazing. That's not going to happen. Get that out of your minds if you think you're going to get a 40%
right.
return on your 401k.
But I think it just shows that, you know, how much growth they've had this quarter. So, yes, as we revert to the mean, we're probably going to see the market slow down here a little bit. But been a good first quarter. I think we have kind of, moved on from worrying about the Fed and inflation.
And I want to talk about the inflation number, which will come out on Good Friday in a minute. But we have talked about headwinds, war in Ukraine, war in the Middle East, a new development this week. My hometown of Baltimore, the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed after being struck by a transport ship. Port of Baltimore is a big part of the supply chain, Jane. Could that be a catalyst for slowing down the market, even though, you know, trucks, cars, I think gypsum, sugar, mm-hmm. all go through Baltimore. So could that slow things down?
Well, it could. I think it remains to be seen because my understanding is these cargo ships are going to be going to Norfolk and to New Jersey. And, you know, there might be logistical issues and backups in those places, but those particular industries, and it's also the biggest coal exporting port.
Yeah.
According to the IEA. So the coal may not be able to get out of the U.S. and where it needs to go. So it could affect those prices. Carnival Cruise Lines says that they may see a $10 million hit because they did travel out of Maryland and they're moving everything to Norfolk, Virginia. But still, that's a disruption in their business and how they do things. And no doubt changes will have to be made. So I think we'll continue to watch this and see because that's going to take a few years for that bridge to be built back.
Yeah. I was talking to my dad and mom. I mean, just and people that I know from Baltimore. I mean, it's about the jobs in and around the port, the 15,000 or so jobs. But they've got to be able to get ships in and out through that causeway and off the Patapsco River. So, yeah, I mean, the other ports are going to have to step up to bring that stuff in. And that's, as you said, going to create logistical issues. So, Jane, the last issue I want to talk about is, so we're doing this a day before Friday, like we typically do. Good Friday, the markets are closed. But on Good Friday, we're going to get some inflation numbers. And by the way, the inflation numbers will be in below us as we talk, but we don't know what they're going to be. So how do markets typically react where the markets are closed, but the Bureau of Labor and Statistics puts out this PCI number?
Yeah, I know. Well, I guess we'll find out Sunday night because that will be the first time the markets are open to react to the number. If it is something just crazy from what expectations are, we could see a reaction. But my sense is the markets since the beginning of the year haven't reacted to these inflation numbers like we have in the past. We've had higher than expected CPI, we've had higher than expected producer prices as well, and the markets just keep going up. So I think maybe we've moved on from inflation and the Federal Reserve and interest rates to more about just the economy in general, maybe the upcoming election, artificial intelligence. What is that going to do to the efficiencies of lots of different industries? So I think the market's kind of shifted its focus and it doesn't seem to be too worried about inflation at the moment.
Yeah. So getting off of that topic, and now it's really, as you said, focus on the traditional measurements, the indices, and then we don't know, Jane, what we know who the candidates are going to be at the presidential election pretty much. I mean, that it isn't official, but it is kind of official. But that in election years, do markets kind of take a step back? Do they are they more measured, I guess, to see who's going to be in the Oval Office and could have control of Congress?
Well, typically, what you used to see was the markets would do well in election years because the party in power would spend more. And that would be kind of stimulative to the economy. You know, they tried to stay in power. But things, you know, 2020 was our last election. That was a weird year. It was COVID.
Yeah.
2016 was kind of strange. A lot of people were surprised by the election results this year. And there's so many unknowns this year. I mean, I feel like we do know who the candidates are, but there's legal issues for Trump, and some people think Biden may step aside and somebody else may. So I feel like there's more questions than normal. We're in a weird time. So we could have, some kind of black swan event, but for now, the markets seem very optimistic.
Yeah, and I think if you're hanging on, not you, Jane, but if the audience is hanging on the 40% return, it's just not going to happen.
I shouldn't have even mentioned it. No,
Yeah,
my
we shouldn't have.
Well,
Your 401k is not going up 40%
my point
this year.
is that if you see 10% gain in one quarter, that probably means we're going to settle back down because 10% is good for a yearly gain. And
Absolutely.
for it to happen for a whole year, we won't see that repeated. I think we're pretty certain of that.
You know, Jane, you make a really good point there, and just to set expectations for the audience, but also a good rule of thumb used to be 8% return. Remember when we were all going to school and we were putting our money away?
That was kind of super good. Yeah.
8%, it just on average is not going to happen on an annual basis. I think the number is what, closer to 5 or 6 that you can expect. And on top of that, you got to pile on the value of the dollar against the inflationary pressure, right? So,
Right.
it all kind of plays in, but yeah, we probably shouldn't have mentioned that. But it's fun to kind of talk about the what ifs. It's just like winning the Powerball, which I didn't win either.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't
Jane,
be here
over.
if I did.
Yeah, that's right. She'd never have been flat.
I would
She
have
would have been
emailed
like,
you, not coming in.
she would have been
All
like, no. Jane, always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for
right.
being really flexible, and we look forward to having you back on the program again next week.
Okay, see you soon.
Thanks, Jane. Great to see you. Thanks for sharing your perspective. And when we come back, we'll take a look at some of our best segments for the week. You're going to want to stay tuned right here on BRN Weekly. Imagine a new television network that will make you richer, healthier, and in control of your financial future. This network is for the policewoman in Nashville, Tennessee, the baker in Dubuque, Iowa, the teacher in Lexington, Kentucky. We want to make the idea of savings and retirement culturally relevant. But what do you see as a defining issue of the midterms?
Especially for the smaller businesses, I mean, they are the lifeblood of the American economy.
Featuring exclusive interviews, current affairs, and docuseries. 33 years old, you retired early.
The philosophy is money only matters if it helps you live a life that you love.
But you gotta start thinking about retirement as soon as you get in.
The Broadcast Retirement Network will drive very high engagement with premium partnerships. So this isn't retirement and savings for your parents or grandparents. This is for all Americans. And we're gonna change the way you think about money. Welcome to the next frontier of retirement and savings. This is BRN, the Broadcast Retirement Network. Welcome back. It was another great week of programs with great topics and, of course, great guests. We kicked off the week with a plan for helping troubled veterans. Let's take a look.
In 2020, the Council on Criminal Justice, which is a nonpartisan and nonprofit think tank and membership organization, was looking at the number of veterans who are incarcerated across our country. and determined that it was necessary to do an evaluation or a global study of the system, the criminal justice system, the Department of Defense, and the VA. In August of 2022, that commission launched as the Veterans Justice Commission, with Secretary Chuck Hagel, former Secretary of Defense, as chair, and also with former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta. There's 13 other amazing commissioners on that commission, and they're studying the nature and extent of veterans in the criminal justice system and making evidence-based recommendations to enhance the health, safety, and justice of our nation's veterans. After World War II, there was a big spike in the number of veterans that were incarcerated across the country. In 1952, there was a study published that examined 11 prisons. And in those 11 prisons, they found a third of all the prisoners were veterans. After Vietnam, we saw numbers as high as 24% of the nation's incarcerated were veterans. One of the things we do at the Council on Criminal Justice is try to tackle extremely difficult questions about our justice system and ones that haven't been explored elsewhere. This is really a question or a study that hasn't been completed before. And as we look at that number of 200,000 veterans incarcerated, that's the most recent data our country has, and it's from 2011. The Council on Criminal Justice and the Veterans Justice Commission thought it was time to update those numbers and really try to take a look at, is there a way to bend that curve down so that 20 years after the two latest conflicts ended, we could have fewer veterans in prison than World War II and Vietnam. So the research shows that the post 9/11 veteran is the most at-risk cohort when compared to the previous conflicts or wars. The post 9/11 veteran, as you will recall, rotated in and out of combat zones over and over and over again. And the research shows that those multiple deployments are what lead to PTSD, and PTSD can be associated with criminal justice involvement. We also know that the post 9/11 veteran is more diverse, more younger, more female, and the research shows that it's all of those factors together that put them at a higher risk. The Veterans Justice Commission was very adamant that they wanted to first examine transition from the military, to your exact point, to try to prevent people from becoming justice involved. We know that because of policy developments and changes in our nation, that about 750,000 veterans since Vietnam have left the military with a bad paper discharge called an other than honorable discharge. That typically takes away all of those mental health benefits. The VA has made some recent changes for emergencies, suicidal emergencies, to try to get 90 days of mental health treatment. But when we compare the system that we have for veterans to the U.S. criminal justice system, we see they're vastly different. In the United States, in criminal justice, we try to apply the resources to those who are most likely to offend or reoffend. In the military and with the VA regulations, we've really done the opposite, where we take the benefits away from that mental health care and healthcare treatment, disability. We take those benefits away from those who have offended or are likely to offend. Going one step further, 20 some years ago in the United States, we made a policy decision that we would no longer give healthcare from the VA to those who are incarcerated. What does that mean? That means if Jim is arrested, put in county jail, while he's receiving PTSD treatment from the VA, that treatment has to stop until Jim gets out of prison or jail. That's the exact opposite thing that we as citizens in America want to happen. We want that individual to be treated because we know they're going to get out eventually, and we want them to leave prison or jail ready to transition into our communities.
Next up, we discussed meeting the threat of fraud head on. Let's take a look.
As you know from previous shows, the Spark Institute developed industry best practices for fraud prevention years ago. And last year, Spark spun the topic of fraud prevention out of the Data Security Oversight Board to have its own dedicated committee. This partner with LIMRA is just a continuation of that focus on fraud prevention. Now, Russ will discuss the continued threat of fraudsters pose to our industry later and to the retirement savings of millions of Americans. But as an example of how partnering improves the overall industry defenses, let me just share this one anecdote with you. About 6 years ago, our members started to see non-family fraud on retirement accounts from outside actors. So Spark brought together the industry members, and together they started to share their experiences of what turned out to be common experiences across members. From that, members learned from one another and closed down these fraudsters. When you look at public data published in 5,500 reports, you actually see this drop in fraud occurrences and losses from accounts. But since then, the numbers have started to trend up as criminals continue to learn and come up with new ways to attack us. So it's really critical for us to continue to improve our efforts on this front. And that's really the purpose of our continued relationship with LIMRA.
It was interesting. It was maybe 6 to 10 years ago when the industry really experienced really a shift in the fraud and fraud experiences they dealt with. It was around that time when what we call third-party account takeover fraud, or really identity exploitation fraud, started to really hit the industry because the fraudsters figured out a couple of things at that point, right? One, there is literally trillions of dollars, right, in retirement accounts and insurance policies. Number two, you know, the industry until that time hadn't dealt with this type of fraud, right? So their authentication standards, their fraud prevention controls weren't necessarily designed at that time, right, to beat back those fraudsters. So when that happened, it really kind of put the industry on notice that there's been a significant change. And as an industry, we need to start working together, right, to combat, you know, this common threat. We have seen, you know, the fraud kind of evolve. You know, it was interesting enough around COVID, we saw kind of a decrease in attacks targeting, you know, the individual member companies and record keepers to some extent, because fraudsters are very opportunistic, right? When the pandemic hit, there was a whole other host of fraud they could go after, right? There was a lot of government money, a lot of funding, a lot of different type of COVID schemes. But sure enough, we've seen, you know, the third-party account takeover fraudsters come back and come back really with a vengeance. Our members use a tool called FraudShare to share information with each other. And according to that data, you know, it gives us really good insights into actual fraud and fraud activity and experiences, you know, in the industry. So last year, right now, the results are still kind of being compiled, but we saw about a 17% increase in attempts in fraud hitting our member companies last year. And that's on top of a 37% increase in attempts in the previous year. And that's just significant because, unfortunately, there's no way to stop these bad actors from trying, right? We can have all the best controls in the world to stop them from being successful, but they're always going to start, you know, continue to try. And why is that? They have incredibly easy access to all the data they need to impersonate any one of us. You know, and I think another important factor, you know, the industry does and continues to do a great job of defending, you know, participant accounts and their records. And what we frequently see almost exclusively is when there is an issue and when somebody is trying to impersonate, you know, one of our participants, it's rare that the breach really occurred at, you know, the record keeper, at the participant company. The breach almost always occurs at other institutions. Just think of all the headlines you've seen over the last decade about all the significant data breaches. Also, potential significant activity targeting individual email accounts, right? We all get multiple emails a day, someone trying to get us to click on a malicious link. One of the reasons, they want to access our email so they can learn all about us. And that's that much easier for them to impersonate us. So what we see the industry doing is working together, sharing information to learn more about how we can better control and beat back, you know, these bad actors. You know, our benchmark survey we're getting ready to roll out, you know, is really encouraging. It indicates almost 90% of all the respondents acknowledge and agree that working together as an industry to share information, share best practices, does work to help combat, you know, beat back the fraudsters. And one thing we'd like to say, and this kind of phrase got adopted early on, when it comes to fighting fraud, you know, we're all peers, not competitors. And that certainly, in my opinion, has helped the industry get much better at combating fraud and successfully, you know, preventing, you know, the fraudsters from being successful.
We do have and continue to spend a lot of resources and effort to protect both plans and participant accounts. Our recent focus, however, is turned to, as Russ pointed out, third-party access and how to improve the protections there. The industry continues to expand connections with other parties to service participants. A good example might be Secure 2.0 now allowing for plans to integrate with student loans. Okay, that is another, just an example of another connection that opens up a new vector for attacks for fraudsters. And so a lot of our focus now has been on those third party interactions and to make sure that there are adequate protections and controls in place to make sure that they don't become the access point for whether it's a data breach or whether it's a fraud.
Yeah, I think the real power initially is going to come from the ability for just greater collaboration, sharing information. You know, what you said is spot on. Between Spark and between LIMRA, we got virtually the entire industry, you know, covered when it comes to retirement and insurance, you know, for the nation. And as I said, our members realized early on, sharing information and communicating with each other is critical. That's how you learn about the evolution of attacks. That's how you learn the different threat indicators that these fraudsters are using. So one thing we're kind of almost wrapping up now is our benchmark survey. We do an annual benchmark survey. This year, we more closely partner with Spark members to incorporate additional questions into the benchmark survey. And it's very comprehensive. It's over 70 different questions. This survey helps all of our members better understand what are the methods used by all the member companies, you know, when it comes to their structure of the fraud prevention teams, the governance, the organization of those teams, the technology they use, their authentication procedures. And that information helps them to kind of compare and benchmark their businesses, their operations against each other, so they can get a sense of, you know, is there anything we're doing that we should do differently? Is there anything we're doing maybe we should start, you know, doing? So we're going to be releasing those results shortly. That's a great example of sharing information with each other in a formal manner. We each have our various committees, sharing information across those committees. One thing we're exploring right now is another consumer piece that can help participants learn what can they do to better protect themselves. And unfortunately, they do suffer the consequences occasionally, right? So occasionally their account is accessed and compromised. We want to make sure we educate, you know, those participants. What actions do you need to take? Because if your account is compromised at one institution, you can rest assured that fraudster or other fraudsters are going to find out where all your other accounts are. They don't necessarily know that, but what they do know is all the phone numbers and the websites of all the financial services companies. So participants need to know, I need to reach out to all my other financial institutions, make sure those accounts are locked down. And there's a whole host of other, you know, tips and tricks they need to employ, credit checks, better security control procedures, a better email, personal computing hygiene. So we're looking to do some pieces on that to help educate the sponsors those participants. And we're also starting to talk now about, we haven't really figured out the name yet, but it's our kind of event, our fraud cybersecurity event. We're going to work to pull, you know, the industry together for, you know, some type of an event in 2025 to help, again, promote sharing information, learning best practices, and keep that going. And then lastly, work together to promote better information sharing through tools and capabilities such as FraudShare that allow members to share with each other in real time or near real time the incidents of fraud and what are the threat indicators those fraudsters are using. And sharing that information helps other members prevent similar or related attacks. So we're super excited about the collaborative partnership. And again, when everybody works together, everybody's stronger, right? And that's kind of our goal going forward.
And that wraps up this episode of BRN Weekly. Have a topic of interest, someone you think we should talk to? Then drop us a line. And don't forget, for all the latest curated news and lifestyle, wellness, finance, tech, so much more in all in one place, check out today's edition of our daily newsletter, The Morning Pulse. Want to search our archives, check out our latest content? Then visit our website. We're not back again tomorrow because of the Easter holiday, but we'll be back again on Monday with another edition of BRN AM. We'll have a very special guest and, of course, an important topic. Until then, I'm Jeff Snyder. Stay safe, keep on saving, and don't forget, roll with the changes. Now is your opportunity to co-create content around any topic on the First Lifestyle and Wellness Network. Reach a global audience through our platform and co-own exclusive branded content. All of our programs are available on demand and also as audio-only podcasts, so you can take us on the go. Broadcast Retirement Network, available anytime, anywhere, and on any device.